The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now, when there's a general election particularly, we love to see how the various parties and candidates are doing in the polls. It doesn't have to be a general election or an election. It can be at any time. Sunday newspapers, I think, very regularly release polling information, and it gives you a kind of an indication how people are thinking. Well, Polling Unpacked is a book that has been written by Mark Pack, who joins me by Zoom this morning. Mark, good to talk to you. Good to see you as well. How are you?
Lovely to join you again. And I'm very envious of your very well air-conditioned studio, I must admit.
If you look very carefully, you will see icicles at the top of my head. That's how cold I like to keep it in here. And I do that in the wintertime as well, by the way. Anyway, good to talk to you today. Polling, we do love a good poll, don't we?
Yeah, and I think it's two things. One is it's almost a bit like an addictive horse race of who's ahead, who's behind, and so on. But also, polling has quite an important public purpose of telling us what people think. And the great thing is they tell us what people who aren't like us, who we don't hang out with, think. And that, whether you're interested in what the public mood is, or you're a politician trying to judge or lead or shape or be influenced by the public mood, is really useful. Informal chat with your mates in the pub definitely can be quite an interesting way of finding out what people think. But the people you chat with in the pub are not going to be the same as the people I chat with in the pub, or the same as the people that 1,001 different listeners might chat with in the pub. So what polls do is they give us that proper overall picture of what people across the board think.
But you can't always believe them, can you? Because there's always a margin of error built in. And then, of course, you have the wascally people who actually won't tell you the truth. They'll just, you know, send you off on a curve as well. And of course, the famous line from politicians is always, well, you can't believe what you see in the polls. You know, the big poll will be on the day when people put the mark on the paper. All of that kind of stuff. So how do we differentiate the good from the bad?
Yeah, well, overall, political polling is pretty accurate. If you look at what proportion of elections, the final polls in the, you know, in the elections where they got the winner right, polling is vastly better than journalists, political pundits, magic animals who supposedly can predict things. You know, polling has got a pretty good track record, but pretty good is not perfect. So a bit of caution and skepticism is definitely in order. And the real, I think the real defining characteristic in many ways of what makes a good poll is it comes from a company that has a bit of a track record and that does lots of non-political polling. Because if you do lots of non-political polling, you don't want to be embarrassed by having your high-profile political poll completely wrong, because that will really damage and put at risk the rest of your business. So that's a really good reassurance. But it's a bit like financial investments. Yeah, past performance isn't always a guide to future performance. So it's easy to tell in hindsight who the good pollsters were. But I think both, you know, both in Britain and in Ireland and across actually most of Europe, there are very few just out and out dodgy, disreputable pollsters. Rather different picture in the US, oddly, but in most of Europe, the sort of pollsters whose voting intention figures will appear in the mainstream media, you can pretty much, yeah, not always, you know, right, not always spot on, but generally they're pretty trustworthy.
I know a fella back home that does this for a living. He's a professional question asker. right? Mm. Or polar. And he told me one night, we were having a few pints and we got chatting about different things, and I didn't realise what he did for a living. And he was telling me about it. But he told me he knows where to go for a particular outcome. He knows the house down the road here on the right-hand side will vote Fianna Fáil. He knows the house on the left-hand side will vote Fianna Gael. And so depending on, you know, what's what, he'll go to one of those.
Yeah, and this has been one of the problems for pollsters in the past, is that if you employ people to go out and ask the public questions, even with the best will in the world, your team will go to the places where they're going to find it easiest to get answers. Mm. And they're going to go to the places they may be most like to walk down the street talking to strangers and the like. And so lots of bias can really easily creep in that way. And so what all the pollsters have to do is work quite hard to select carefully who they choose to try to speak to, so that you get a properly representative sample, that you don't, you know, if you're sending people out to do polling in person, that you don't just get answers from people who live in the nice area of town where your staff might want to spend the day. So that's a real, and that when the polls have gone wrong, that's often been part of the story, that they've ended up with an untypical cross-section of people. So, for example, in the US elections in 2016 and in 2020 for president, one of the problems the pollsters struggled with was there was a group of Trump supporters who really had bought into all of his stuff about how polls are all nonsense, all fiction, and so on. And not surprisingly, those supporters were a bit less willing to therefore take part in polls themselves.
Yeah.
And so there are lots of things pollsters did to try and overcome that. And they were, they were decent. I mean, they got it right that Biden was going to be the winner in 2020. They even got it right in 2016 that Hillary Clinton was going to win more votes than Trump. But in both cases, they weren't spot on. And in part, that's because of that challenge, the equivalent of exactly the factor your friend described.
Mm-hmm. Where did it all start? Where did it begin that people started to put faith in polling and how it works?
Polling really started in the early 19th century in the US. There was a presidential election in 1824, where people started getting members of the public who, for example, had been called to militia muster meetings. So that would be a pretty good cross-section of at least the adult white males in an area.
Mm-hmm.
Doing sort of straw polls there to say, well, all of you have come together for your militia muster, which of the presidential candidates do you support? So that sort of straw polling took off in the early 19th century, but the real birth of modern political polling was in the early 20th century in the US, where three pollsters, of whom the best self-publicist was George Gallup, so he's the one that's normally remembered, but Roper and Crosley as well were the other two, they started doing the sort of modern scientific polling of actually understanding the statistics and the maths behind how you get a properly representative group of people. And there was one famous election in 1936 where the old-fashioned straw polling, particularly from the Literary Digest magazine, suggested the Republican was going to win by a landslide. Gallup, Crosley and Roper, with their modern polling, all said the Democrat was going to win. The Democrat won. The reputation of modern polling was made. And the Literary Digest almost published a humble apology in their following edition. It starts off humble, but they get back to bragging about how great they are about halfway through.
Mm. In the notes that I've seen in relation to the book, you also talk about how polling was, there were attempts by politicians to ban polling at one point.
Yeah, I think, and you still, it's quite common to ban polls, at least in the last few days before an election.
Yeah.
I think there is a fear that if polls are in some way wrong, that may mislead the public. And particularly if there's a poll that comes out that's wrong and it comes out just before polling day, there might not be a chance for anyone else to do another poll or to set the record right or whatever. And that, I think, is understandable, the desire to maybe not have polls right at the last moment. But there's also a more widespread view, which I happen to disagree with, that somehow it's wrong to pay attention to what the public thinks. Politicians should pick what they think is right, and they should argue that, and it's sullying politics somehow to pay attention to what the public thinks. Or that if you're a voter, that it's somehow sullying your voting choice if you're thinking, well, that party might not win, so I won't vote for them, but I might vote for this other party instead. But actually, I think in both cases, it's perfectly reasonable, even desirable, to know what other people are thinking. And if you don't have polls, you have all sorts of other inferior sources of information that people turn to. So I think there is definitely, I mean, in the UK, for example, we have a ban on polls being published when the polling stations are open on polling day.
Yeah, okay.
A ban on new polling being done when polling stations are open on polling day. So you have that sort of, you know, exit polls. You can do them mm-hmm. on polling day, but you can't publish them until the close of polls to sort of try and protect against the idea that it might put people off voting. And that, I think, is very reasonable. But overall, I think, you know, it's a good thing if the public and politicians have access to the best information possible, and that is very often polling.
Are we led by the polling that we read or that we hear about? If everybody's voting for him or her, then maybe I should too.
Yeah, that bandwagon effect was a big concern in the early 20th century about would this mean that you end up with a very sort of polarised, ossified politics where everyone backs the winner and therefore the winner always wins and so on. The academic sort of research evidence is that effect is fairly muted. It's not that big. It does it happens in two particular areas, though. One is where people decide to vote tactically in first-past-the-post electoral systems. And actually, I think that's good. If polling helps inform people how to best use their vote, that's a good thing. And the other is an equivalent of that you get with some proportional representation systems. If there's a vote threshold below which you automatically don't win any seats, then again, you can sometimes see that if a party is, say, just below that threshold, there is a bit of a bandwagon effect for people to push it above, or possibly its support collapses because everyone thinks they're not going to win any seats. Let's vote for someone else. But again, both of those, I think, are quite good. The public is being able to make a better decision about how to make its vote effective because it knows what other people are thinking.
Does the book go into the science behind the questions that are asked? Because there is often, it's very easy to say, are you going to vote Conservative or Labour or others, or you know, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Green Party, Labour, whatever the case might be. But it's more intricate than that, and it's more scientific than that sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's particularly for issues that the public hasn't given that much thought to, and it doesn't, or that are very complex, and maybe the public's given a little bit of thought to, but you're just asked a quick polling question and you give a snap answer. The wording can be really quite influential. We saw this, for example, in the aftermath of the Brexit referendum in the UK, that asking a question about whether you thought there should be a further referendum on the terms of the Brexit deal, you could get very different answers depending on whether the question sounded like, we've had one vote, should we just have another vote again? Or, we didn't know what the terms of the deal would be. When we do know them, should we have a vote for the public rather than politicians to decide at that point? So you could get very different. But what I think that variation illustrates is not so much a weakness with polling, but that on complex issues or ones the public doesn't think, you know, most of the time very much about, public opinion is very amenable to being persuaded. And so the variation in answers, depending on the wording, is telling us something useful about the public. Where it's questions where people do give them a lot of thought, or they're, you know, relatively easy questions to answer, the wording doesn't have nearly as much impact. So the way in which people are asked the question, which party will you vote for, or which candidate will you vote for, that wording tends to make very little difference, with one or two just sort of particular niche exceptions, because that's just a much more straightforward question than something like, what should taxes go up or the health service receive less money? That's a more complex, oh, well, maybe I want a bit of one, bit of the other. So different wording gets different answers.
How does the, or what's the importance of storing the information that you get so that these can be audited? Is there such a thing as an audit? Can, can investigators, whoever they might be, can they actually go to the marketing company and say, show me the data, show me the information, and how you got the information from that?
The really important bit of information is the full wording of the polling question, for the reasons that we've talked about, and that particularly, even if you've got a reasonably worded polling question, the way it can then get reported in the media, you could just end up the meaning slipping and slipping and slipping. I think actually, no, being able to see the original question is quite important. And generally, in most countries, that's now a fairly standard thing that's available. Transparency beyond that does vary hugely between countries. I was really surprised when researching the book to discover how secretive Australian pollsters are, for example, that when the last but one Australian election, the polls were not particularly good. And so there was an the inquiry afterwards, and the pollsters really, by sort of British standards or, you know, other country standards, really were reluctant to cooperate with the polling inquiry. The sort of basic information that is widely available from pollsters in other countries, Australian pollsters were very reluctant to hand over. I think they've realised now that they were more secretive than they should be, because there's been a new initiative to make Australian polling more transparent. But the polling question, the exact wording, is the really key bit of information.
And are there any key, you know, you may have answered that in just what you said there about Australia, are there any key aspects, or are there any regulations that need to be adhered to that will be standard across the world, or is it up to each country to regulate their own?
Yeah, so each country has or doesn't have either its own legislative rules. In a lot of countries, there are industry self-regulation rules. So in Britain, for example, the legislation around polling is fairly limited, but there's also a very strong set of transparency requirements from the industry self-regulatory body. And it tends to be around transparency and this question of whether polling should be banned for particular periods of time as you get closer to polling day. I think there is a lot of possible further development around those transparency rules, because as we've seen the rise of online polling, internet panels are pretty much the standard way of doing polling now in many places, and also new methodologies like MRP, there's more technical information that it would be useful to have, you know, readily available. So typically you might be able to get the wording of the question, the date the polling was done, and how many people were asked. But other bits of information, like if it's an internet panel, is it that company's own panel, or did they buy in that data from other places?
Okay.
Because if you buy in the data from other places, the quality is more risky.
And you could be more selective.
So I think that hopefully we will see in future years a widening of that basic sort of trio of transparency requirements.
Okay, and I was just about to ask you about technology, and apart from obviously being able to put together the answers and the information much faster, has technology played a big part? Now, the internet audience, as you said, is one of those, but has technology played a major role in the advancement of it?
Yeah, and I think in two ways. One is the speed. And when you've got something like a big TV debate between political party leaders, for example, in an election, the speed with which a poll can be released telling us all who the public thought performed best, that's actually quite influential and actually preferable to the alternative of other political pundits guessing what they think the public might have thought. So when there's a big news moment, speedy polling, that's been really important. And the second, as you rightly say, is internet polling. It used to be that most polling was done door to door, but that's quite slow, expensive, and people have become increasingly reluctant to open their door to strangers in many places, and the spread of intercoms and gated estates and so on. Then telephone polling took off, but now landline phone numbers are on the decline, and I mean, quite possibly a majority of listeners this morning may well not have a landline anymore. And so internet polling has become the clear future for polling, and without internet polling would be in a really bad state in most countries at the moment. It is tricky, because with internet polling, are you really getting a representative? You know, you can pick a set of phone numbers at random, you can pick a set of doors at random. With internet polling, you have to create a panel, which becomes a selective process in itself. But you look at the record of good internet pollsters, they're as good as telephone pollsters. You know, it's not like the quality has dropped, but it's definitely possible to do cheap, dodgy, low quality online polling, which is why looking out for those reputable companies, as we talked about earlier, makes sense.
Do we like to be polled?
It's curious that yes, because if you think about it, a complete stranger saying, can I have 15, 20 minutes of your time ask a whole load of questions, is quite an intrusion.
Yeah.
And although response rates for polls have fallen quite a lot, so how many people are willing to spend 20 minutes talking to a stranger on the telephone, say, that has fallen a lot. With internet polling, you know, pollsters don't particularly struggle to get enough people overall. What can be a struggle are particular groups of people. So very often, teenage men are a real struggle to reach enough of them to be able to get, you know, properly representative a poll overall. But overall, people's willingness to talk with strangers about topics they may have never thought about before is still a little bit of a wonder.
Incredible stuff. All right. The book is called Polling Unpacked, The History, Uses and Abuses of Political Opinion Polls, written by Mark Pack, who's been talking to us for the last 20 minutes or thereabouts. Mark, it's a fascinating story. We do love to hear the polls, I know that. I suppose it's just going to be more a part of what we do, because indeed, no matter where you go these days on the internet, there is a story. You know, how much do you know about this movie? How, you know, whatever Elvis was released, you go online, how much do you know about Elvis? And you're answering the questions and you just don't know really what they want to know. You know, they're building profiles and they're building information on you that is going, you know, who knows where. But anyway, look, it's a fascinating read. It is available for our listeners on our website, tre.radio. That's where you will find it. We have a bookstore there and it is available, Mark. So listen, thanks a million for talking to us about it. I wish you well with it and good luck with what you do.
Lovely talking to you this morning.
Chat soon. Bye-bye.